You're listening to Grace and Fire, brought to you by Emerging Women. Today, my guest is Amanda Palmer. Amanda Palmer is literally a rock star, a former street performer, and a crowdfunding pioneer who knows all about asking. Performing as a living statue in a wedding dress in Harvard Square, she wordlessly asked thousands of passersby for their dollars. After creating the world's most successful music Kickstarter campaign for her album with the Grand Theft Orchestra, she has now written a book titled The Art of Asking, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Let People Help. In this new memoir, she tells the story of an artist struggling with the new rules of exchange in the 21st century and inspires readers to rethink their own ideas about asking, giving, art, and love. There are so many cool things about this woman, not least of which is her postmodern retro-punk cabaret band called the Dresden Dolls. Do check them out. She is also married to Neil Gaiman, my favorite comic book illustrator and writer of all things fantastic. Check him out too. But perhaps what I love the most about Amanda Palmer is the fact that her nickname is Amanda fucking Palmer. Somehow it just feels right. In today's episode, Amanda and I spoke about the art of asking and how she learned this art, a constant theme in her life, balancing vulnerability with control, dealing with the fear of rejection and how to ask anyway, relationship-based communication, and the need to still ask for help. And finally, the art of receiving as an integral part of the ask. Here is my conversation, The Art and Power of Asking, with the wildly inspirational Amanda fucking Palmer. Hi, welcome, Amanda. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm a little bit outside myself because I feel like I've been stalking you a little bit. So I'm so excited. For the listeners who are tuning in here, this is my first time really talking to Amanda. I think we spoke for like a half a minute prior to this. And I've been reading your book. I'm saying that in quotes here because I love to listen to books on audio. So I feel.
Oh, great.
Yes. And I want to say that I'm promoting the audio version of The Art of Asking because there's so much in there that's not in the book. And I feel like I've really gotten to know you through it and your voice. So intimacy.
It's really nice as a musician to put out an audiobook. Because that's my medium. that's what I'm used to. And it's really nice to have the music and the song lead them into the story. They really belong there.
I love that you sang your intro. It was fabulous. it was so great.
Thank you. Oh, I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. I just thought it was just so unique. And you, just by way of full disclosure, I'm just going to get this out here now so we can get the stalking vibration out. So I am also a huge fan. Like when I was in college, it was Love and Rockets and The Sandman. I mean, that was like my deal. So huge fan of your husband, Neil Gaiman, and his work. And when I saw you coming forward on the fabulous TED Talk, and I realized who you were, I was like, oh my God, can you be in love with like a couple? But that's what
totally.
Happened. So
if you're polyamorous.
Right? Okay. You're making me. So I was in love with Neil and now I'm in love with you. And like the two of you together just makes so much groovy sense. It's off the charts. So I feel especially honored today.
Thank you. Thank you. It makes me really happy when people love Neil's work because I love him. And I also, I mean, the really lucky thing was I wasn't a Neil Gaiman fan. And I think that might've been a deal breaker. So I got to fall in love with, the weird guy, not the Sandman author.
Right.
I had to catch up.
Right. Oh, great. What I thought we would start with today is maybe a little background on how you came into this work. And I know a lot of this stems from your experience as a traveling musician and a performing artist, but the work I'm referring to is this art of asking and how that emerged inside of you and what the journey was, and where does it play out in different parts of your life?
Oh my God, that's like an hour long.
Well, you're gonna talk and I'm gonna interrupt. That's usually how these podcasts go.
Well, I mean, the first thing that makes me think of is the fundamental training that I got without totally realizing it as it was happening, when I was a street performer. And I grew up in a kind of a basic suburban situation, you know, not a lot of artists around me. But, you know, very, very, very into music and theater and, record collecting and everything I could get my hands on. And, you know, but, you know, a pretty, you know, a politically liberal, but, you know, somewhat conservative family, in that, you know, there was one path. You went to college and you went to a liberal arts college, and that's what all my older brothers and sisters did, and that's what you did in my family. And I kind of went kicking and screaming because I didn't, you know, I just had no desire to go to college, but I went. And I didn't have the best of times. I kind of suffered through it. But as soon as I got out the other side and was finally free to make my own decisions in life, I went straight to the street and became a street performer. Mm. And no one guided me. I didn't have a street performer mentor. I didn't even really know any street performers. I just saw people doing it and thought, who's going to stop me from doing that if I get up and do it? So from the time I graduated college, I made money in a ton of strange ways, but my primary income for 4 or 5 years was in Harvard Square as a living statue standing on a box. And I talk about that in my TED Talk, and I talk about it at length in the book. And it really, you know, I definitely started out, you know, with a particular bent, but standing on a box and, you know, and standing still until strangers give you money and then having a moment of connection with them year after year after year really did pound in the philosophy that I kind of tentatively started with to begin with, which is just the idea that human beings, you know, if given the opportunity, are fundamentally generous, do want to connect with each other, do like helping artists. You know, it's very sort of maybe naive, but definitely optimistic outlook that if I wanted to be an artist, I would find the people who wanted to help because I knew they existed. Mm-hmm. And that's the attitude that I brought to music when I started a band, which is, you know, which was my real passion because I was a songwriter and I knew I wanted to fundamentally follow that path. And I sort of just took my street performing attitude into rock and roll. And it didn't feel strange to me and didn't seem odd to constantly invite my fans onto stage and ask them for help and constantly connect with everybody and answer every fan letter and, you know, stand in the mix of my fans and not separate myself. But, you know, as I traveled through the world more and more, I realized that the way the Dregs involved did it, which was my band, I want to say it was unique, but it wasn't even unique. It was just a different lineage. And, you know, even though we were working in the world of rock and roll, we were sort of like a folk band with rock music, because mm-hmm. we were about the community and we were about staying with our fans and we were about trying to help everybody. And we had a lot more in common with the folk scene and the punk scene than we did with the rock scene and the rock circuit that we were mostly touring on.
And so just to clarify, the human statue, you were a mime bride, which I think is lovely, right? Is that correct? You were dressed in a bride's outfit?
Yeah, I was all white, covered in a giant white gown with white gloves and a black wig. And mostly, unless I was at a crazy festival where I just couldn't keep up with the demand, I handed out white daisy palms. And, you know, in a shift, a work shift was just as long as the flowers lasted. I was done.
Right. You know, there's something, and this I know plays out also when you're playing music, but there's something about that that's both intimate and isolating. And I'm wondering if you could express that a little bit, where you're frozen, and you say this in your, you know, I'm saying in the book, where it's almost like protection, or you can retreat, even though you're out there in the middle of Harvard Square and you're totally exposed, and sometimes it's raining and sometimes, you know, people are not so nice. And but at the same time, you refer to it as like a almost a protection that you can hide behind your stillness. And I thought that was so interesting. And I'd love to hear more about what that's like for you.
You know, that's, you know, what's fascinating about that is that there's such a parallel between what you just said and that aspect of being a living statue and what it's like to be on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Singing these really vulnerable songs and you know, pouring your heart out and bearing yourself, but simultaneously you're kind of in control. You know, you're the one in the spotlight, you're the one behind the piano, you're the one deciding how far you want to push things and how much you want to reveal yourself and how much you want to pull back, which you decide moment to moment, depending on the venue and the audience and how much you, you know, how much you are able to give in that moment and how much you trust that particular audience. And it's almost the same thing. And you know, one of the things that I've just, they're one of the themes of my life that I've been so fascinated by, because it shows up everywhere in my marriage, in my job history, on stage. You know, it's a real tightrope between control and total vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of balancing between these two extremes all the time. I mean, look who I picked for a husband. Like,
mm-hmm.
I picked this gigantic guy, you know, with huge, you know, fame and busyness and stuff, but who was also really vulnerable. I mean, Neil is the perfect example of those extremes in himself, and it's part of why we really recognized each other. And in all of the jobs I've done, you know, I was a dominatrix, for Christ's sake. Like, that's a job that I actually just finished reading a fantastic book by Melissa Fiebe, who details her 4 years of working in a dungeon in New York City. And it's the same thing. You know, there's this sort of facade of ultimate control, but also you're the employee. You're the one getting paid. There's this kind of crazy dance between, well, who actually is in power here? And I felt that as a statue, and I felt it as a stripper, and I felt it as a dominatrix, and I still feel it on stage, and I feel it with my husband. And it's that amazing yin yang of, you know, dancing between control and no control.
In that art of asking, is there a certain ratio of control to vulnerability that actually yields better results? Not that one is, you know, always asking with a specific result in mind, but, you know, sometimes, and I think you're a master of this, you ask in ways when you don't even verbally ask for things. I mean, we're going to get to that, but what is it like? Is it, if you ask with more vulnerability, you'll get what you want? Or is it if you have more control over the messaging when you ask? I mean, what is that interplay between control and vulnerability in the art of asking?
I mean, the crazy thing about that is that it's so specific to the situation. And people who are good at asking know that, you know, wherever you are in whatever position or situation you're standing and facing somebody else, whether you are the asker or the askee, part of being good at asking is knowing that the, you know, the ecosystem of the balance of power is different in every moment with every situation, that there, you know, there are moments where being vulnerable is approaches the idiotic and the masochistic. And then there's moments where showing your vulnerability actually pulls you up to a place of real empowerment, because there are times where we're being truly, truly vulnerable, you know, not just faking it and not just saying the words and not just, you know, not just offering up the token because you think you're going to get what you want. But, you know, those moments and knowing how to shift those gears that is just like the work of life. And that is the work of every single human being I know who's decided to be in relationship with other people, which is everybody, mm-hmm. you know. And that's the, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that I found so lovely about this book is when it came down to it, I realized that the stuff that I was talking about was so fundamental to everybody I knew in a relationship, which is when do you face your pride, swallow your pride, and just ask for what you need? And, you know, and what's getting in the way if you're finding yourself unable to do that? And on the flip side, what's too much to ask for? When do you turn into that needy asshole instead of someone who is truly stepping up to the plate and making yourself vulnerable and asking for something reasonable? Mm-hmm. And we all torture ourselves with these questions all day. Mm-hmm. You know, am I asking for too much for my husband? Am I taking too much? Am I being too selfish? Am I being too greedy? All those things.
Well, how do you know?
Search me. I don't know. I think if I knew, I'd explode in a beam of light and never be seen again.
Yeah,
I don't think you know. I think it's the meaning of life. You search for it, but you know you're never going to find it.
Yeah, I wonder though. After reading your book, I feel like the default is to ask and then deal with the repercussions after, rather than not ask.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty safe default. Is when in doubt, if you're in actual serious doubt, then you know, chances are, for the vast majority of people I know, yeah, the default should be you're probably afraid, and if you're really on the fence, you know, eat it and ask, because that's usually the correct door. But that, again, that really depends, you know, in certain situations. I face this with younger musicians all the time who see the flip side of that, because they sometimes ask before they're ready. They ask before they have enough to give. They ask before they're ready to do the work. They ask, you know, they ask the universe to pay for their tour bus, but they don't have a fan base yet. Mm. And it's in cases like that where I'm like, you know, you're not ready yet. Mm. You can't ask before you have an audience. Mm-hmm. You can't go out on a first date with someone and be like, so do you want to have kids? Do you want to get married? I'm just asking. Mm-hmm. Like, that's actually not mm-hmm. the best bet. Mm-hmm. It's context.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with rejection?
Badly, usually.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Oh man, I mean, it's definitely gotten easier, and I don't just say that to be corny, mm-hmm. but you know, I've dealt with my fair share of it in the industry, you know, within the music business, and certainly, you know, internet wise and personally, you know, I've been rejected, you know, as a person with ideas, as a woman who, you know, won't, you know, cop to the beauty standard, as a million things. And one of the things I've found about life is that if you trudge on, it just gets easier. It gets easier to be rejected because you just stop taking it so personally. Mm-hmm. You know, Neil said something really funny to me once when he was talking about reading reviews of his first book, or his first big book, when he put American Gods out. And the reviews started to come in, you know, especially like the user reviews, the customer reviews on Amazon. And they were either really glowing or like really, really shitty. He was just stacking up all these one-star and five-star reviews, and there was nothing in the middle, which feels very much like my life. Like, my life seems to be a sea of one-star and five-star reviews. And he said he got to a certain point where he stopped reading any of the reviews, but just started counting them. Mm. And he figured if he was getting a lot of reviews, whether they were one-star reviews or five-star reviews, mm-hmm. the book was probably doing well. Mm-hmm. And that's like a great metaphor for dealing with rejection and criticism, which is, you know, especially when you start realizing that life isn't personal and that most people who are out there aggressively rejecting me are dealing with their own fears and their own issues, it all starts to feel a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And especially when you've built up your own community of smart and interesting people who actually do understand me and know where I'm coming from and are happy to have, you know, a dialogue about ideas instead of an outright rejection of who I am. There's plenty enough to feed me while all that noise goes on in the background, and it gets a lot easier to ignore.
Let's talk more about that. That is also another theme throughout the book. And I just, you know, just the way you market is this really what I consider sort of a new approach to the economy, really, is relationship-based communication, where you're not just sending out communication in a one-way vehicle. You seem to have a lot of, you're working with Reverb, and it seems like it's a conversation. And I'm curious how that has helped shape your work on asking through this, you know, building this very, you know, this wide net that you've cast in relationship and dialogue. How does that art of asking play out in that arena?
Well, it's been everything, because if I had started the band and then moved on to my solo career, which I did in 2008, if I hadn't gotten the response that I did, and I hadn't had the conversation partners that I had on the internet, whether it was by blog comments in the early days or MySpace later, and then with Twitter and Facebook and all the various forms of social media, if I hadn't had an intelligent dialogue partner in my fans, I would kind of be working in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't feel like I was collectively part of something. Which I have to say is something that really fascinates me about huge pop stars who have giant social media followings, but they have such big followings with such like giant percentage of what seems to be like vapid conversationalists that I wonder if, you know, if I'm not just really lucky to be in a sweet spot where, you know, I post a photo on Instagram or, you know, I post an article on Facebook and all of the responses that I see are intelligent responses about the content and about the ideas and, about life and about love and about, you know, they're smart responses. And then you go to an Instagram post by, you know, Katy Perry or Justin Bieber or Lady Gaga or a huge pop star, and all you see is like, oh my God, I love you. Oh my God, I love you. Oh my God, when are you going to come to Brazil? Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And I'm like, man, that must be so lonely because you don't get to talk. You know, you don't get to go back and forth. You sort of get showered with unconditional love, but you don't get to engage in a conversation. Mm. And that's what I love. What I love is that I've been engaged in an awesome, funny, intelligent conversation with my fans since, you know, 2000, one since I first started my blog. Mm. And that's made everything possible. If that conversation hadn't been happening, my Kickstarter wouldn't have been successful. You know, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, launch a Patreon yesterday and get everyone in the community saying, of course, we're going to help you. You know, we've known you for years. We trust you. We think this is great. And, you know, and that speaks as much for the, like, the caliber of the fan base than it does for me, because, you know, you don't get to pick your fans. They pick you. And then you just hope that they're good, intelligent people.
Yeah, but there's also, I think, something in the way that you're delivering your art, which is this, like you said, very back and forth. It's a dialogue that creates the space not only for asking. In other words, there's a lot that happens through the community that you've built where you're manifesting, so to speak, a lot of what's useful to you as an artist through just having relationships and instead of just having to ask all the time. And I think that's the magic, you know, watching you lead with your dialogue, leading with relationship. The rest, it's almost like, do you really even need to ask when you have that?
Well, except that you do. Because if you don't ever ask, you know, you never get paid.
Got it. Right.
And, you know, at the end of the day, I still need to run a business.
Right.
And I have to decide, you know, I could just sort of like go out, put all my music up for free on YouTube and like chat away on Facebook all day, but I'd never be paid for anything. And everyone would be very happy to engage. But, you know, my way of getting paid a couple years ago was Kickstarter. My way of getting paid nowadays is going to be Patreon. And that's also a choice, like, not to go get a giant label advance, not to get paid by the industry, but to ask my fans to just pay me directly so that I don't have to sign with a label, so that I don't, you know, have to go through a bigger channel and a middleman. Mm-hmm. Even though that's got its advantages. I mean, I certainly did that with the book. And I could have chosen not to. I could have just gone straight to my fan base and said, hey, who's going to pre-order a book for $30? Mm-hmm. And, you know, pre-order it now. I'm going to write it for the next year. You guys will get this book in a year. You know, and I probably would have made a killing at the outset, but I have, you know, I kind of wanted people outside my fan base to read the book. I didn't want to just mail it to the choir. I wanted to work with a publisher who could bring in people outside my fan base. Cause I wanted this book to be for everybody. So I chose to work within the system, and I took an advance from a publisher, and I worked for them, and I did it really happily. Mm-hmm. You know, I was glad I did it that way.
Mm-hmm. A lot of like your messaging and your music and also the way that you're promoting yourself through this heavy community-oriented dialogue, there's opportunity there to, you know, address issues that are important to you and to dialogue on issues that actually make a difference in the world. And recently you had there's like reference to political correctness. And, you know, I'm just curious to see what you think of that and how art can reflect different mindsets and how that's an edge for you at times. Being PC, so to speak, but also having the freedom to really be artistically expressive.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge topic right now for everybody in a lot of ways. I think, you know, I've always been a real champion of art being able to be as you know, politically incorrect and as risky and as brave and as offensive, if it needs to be, as possible. Because I think that's what art is for. I think the forum, you know, and the stage for art is where we are allowed to go crazy. Mm-hmm. That being said, you know, I believe deeply in compassion for everybody, and I do not like seeing anybody harmed. So, you know, certainly that cannot include You know, that can't include like performance art where you slice people's throats open. And it, you know, and it shouldn't include, you know, it shouldn't include a world in which, you know, political cartoonists are getting gunned down for expressing themselves. I think, you know, I think the dialogue that popped up after Charlie Hebdo was, you know, it was definitely one worth having, but it was painful to me to see people saying like, well, wait a second, maybe the problem here is that we should dial back on the art because maybe this art is dangerous. And it's like, no, that's a really slippery slope, guys. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the minute you start deciding to censor a little bit of art over here and a little bit of art over there, we've seen what happens with that in the past. That's when you wind up in a dictatorship eventually. Mm-hmm. And it's just too dangerous. So, you know, it's better. I would rather live in a world where art is allowed to be offensive and then we argue about the ideas and we declare our offendedness than a world where we just zip it and don't create things that might cause waves, because that's when we all go down together. And it's too dangerous. I sort of feel the same way about political correctness. I mean, you know, I'm a huge feminist and I'm a champion for, you know, anybody who has been victimized in any way. But the one thing I see happening constantly nowadays on the internet is, you know, women especially tearing each other apart when they should be helping each other. And a lot of it is, you know, is over political correctness and language, and it's really disheartening, you know, to see so many people's intentions, you know, which you can kind of feel out are all fundamentally good, clashing with each other so badly that you sort of you feel like the whole ship is just sinking because people are, you know, so unable to be tolerant of the slightest difference in approach, the slightest difference in language, you know, and you've got, you know, and then you just wind up with everybody divided, and you wind up with black feminists screaming at white feminists and white feminists screaming at trans people who are using the wrong fucking language. And you're just like, guys, this isn't going to work. There needs to be a larger umbrella of understanding and compassion and tolerance. And I feel like it is backsliding at an alarming rate, and it really worries me.
Well, that's why I feel like the opportunity lies in the hands of the artists, because this is so complicated. And the more that we try and put it into boxes and put labels on them, you know, and try and come up with rules of engagement and, you know, diction, I think we just keep pinning ourselves further and further away from the core and the intention of our desires. And that is on the women's side to just, you know, really a world where we can have free expression across all colors and sectors. And so to me, the mess is an opportunity for artists to really kind of just unleash themselves in these arenas and let the conversations ensue from there, rather than the policymakers or, you know, like, let's get this feminist thing right. She didn't mention women of color. She didn't mention, you know, transgender. Right. And it just feels so oppressive and, quite frankly, masculine. So, I mean, I want some chaos like around
it. It's like a weird new form of oppression. Well, me in my, like, super hippy-dippy way, you know, my approach is always, well, if we all just were able to step back and practice hardcore compassion and really, really take the worldview that everybody deserves compassion. I mean, everybody from the left to the right. Every single human being, no matter what they've done, no matter what they've perpetrated, no matter, you know, if you can take a worldview that extreme, that, you know, everyone deserves compassion, including the people who've wronged you, harmed you, hurt you. That's been my life practice. Mm-hmm. And it has changed everything. And it does change everything. You know, you find yourself just unable to hate people, unable to judge people without feeling really terrible about it, unable to scream at anybody. Because the feedback is just so fast, you know, it's not helping, mm-hmm. that you're not being compassionate, that the greater good is not being served when you engage with anger and with fear. And, you know, and anger has its place in the, you know, when it's time for a change and you really have to move, anger can be a great motivator. Mm-hmm. But it can also, you know, it can also eat its own tail pretty quickly. And that's what I feel like I see happening all the time, is anger, you know, getting so misguided and so overused, and outrage being such a instinctive reaction on the part of so many people so fast. That you're like, man, we should be saving this for the big one, because if we're all just using up our outrage daily on Tumblr, yelling at this person, that person, and the other one for being slightly imperfect, we're not going to have the energy we need when it comes to, you know, really putting the energy where it matters, mm-hmm. saving the planet, taking care of each other, doing the things that are hugely important and don't just have to do with the verbiage on an Instagram post.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to switch back here to this asking. So, you know, you've cultivated an art, and the saying goes that we end up teaching on things that we need to learn the most for ourselves. And just listening to your story with Neil and how your relationship's playing out, I just know how hard it has been for you to ask. But here's my question. What about receiving? How are you as a receiver?
It's also really hard.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, it is ultimately the same practice. It really is. If you're, you know, if you're looking at the art of asking, you might as well call it the art of receiving, because you can't master one without trying to master the other. Mm-hmm. Because you're never just on one side of the fence. You're always, you know, you're always switching back and forth. They are one in the same. They are the opposite sides of the same coin. You cannot, you know, the same way that you can't, you know, claim to be practicing compassion, but you won't allow other people to have compassion for you because you're too wrapped up in it. You're too masochistic. You feel that you're too undeserving or whatnot. You really have to let it flow both ways or it doesn't work. And the art of receiving is, you know, I discussed this in the book. One of the things that is so hard about asking is that somewhere under there, you feel unworthy to receive.
Mm, right.
And that can be the biggest thing that trips you up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that you feel rude. It's not that you feel, it's that you feel like maybe I don't deserve to ask for this. Maybe this is too much. Maybe this is not right. And, you know, a lot of it is we're, you know, especially in this culture where things are so wonky and we're sent this bizarro split message, especially as women. On the one hand, you know, if you look at all the marketing that's aimed at women, on the one hand, it's all about, like, you're good enough, you're smart enough, you're so powerful, you can be anything you want, you're so brave. You know, it's kind of all of this overbloated, you know, like, mad independent self-confidence. And then almost in the same breath, you're told you're completely inadequate, you know, and, you know, unless you are perfect, unless you look great, unless you have money, unless, you're kind of unworthy. And you wonder why everyone is freaking out nowadays and, like, living in a permanent identity crisis.
Mm-hmm.
because we're constantly being sent a mixed message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's, to me, the power of really having strong relationships around you to just make the world sane as these inputs come in. We need to process them and having that dialogue with people we admire is probably the only way to get through all of that before it changes. So my next question, this will be our last. I'm curious if you have words of wisdom for women that are emerging. So they're on an edge, the emergence process, you know, when you're about to create something huge or you've got an idea and you're on fire about it, you can't sleep, you're expanding, you know, but with that comes fear. With that comes self-doubt. With that comes, I don't want to ask this, you know, feelings of isolation. And so what advice would you give to women who are on that precipice of a great emergence?
I think the best advice there is to remind women, or anyone really, that fear is not the enemy, and that fear is really normal, and that the real practice and the, you know, and the wisdom comes with just working with the fear. Because anybody who tells you that they are trying to, you know, whether they're an artist or a business person or whatever, that they're, you know, trying to change the world and they're trying to break paradigms and they're trying to create great art, anyone who tells you that they did it fearlessly is just lying. It's just not. Mm-hmm. There's always a fear of rejection or of, you know, that you're not going to be able to get it as perfectly as you saw it in your mind, or that you're going to piss somebody off, or that you're not going to hit it right. I mean, the fears are endless. They're just limitless. Yeah. But you do it anyway. And I think one of the problems that a lot of artists have and a lot of women have is they think they're supposed to not be afraid. And they think there's somehow something wrong with them if they're approaching the precipice, you know, the precipice, and their heart stops, you know, beating and they freak out. And it's like, nope, that's totally normal. That's kind of the way it plays out. And, you know, and the difference between, you know, that choice you make in that moment to just like take a deep breath and sit with the fear and do it anyway and risk failure and risk, you know, being shamed and risk people looking at you like you're crazy and, you know, risk losing money and risk getting yelled at, whatever it is, you know, taking the risk while you're afraid anyway, that is the work. And it can be really comforting to remember that, you know, from giant CEOs to huge rock stars, that we're actually always a little afraid when we step up to the podium, but, you know, we do it anyway. And you're like, yep, I'm afraid. Oh, yep, there's that huge afraid feeling. Yep, I recognize you. Here we go anyway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there's something in not feeling alone in your fear that's just really nice. And I have to say, having met so many other women, huge performers and, you know, women who run giant companies and women who are, you know, off changing the world in a million ways, to know that they're just as insecure and freaked out and often indecisive and, you know, constantly struggling with regret and whatever it is. You know, the more I've traveled and talked to these women, and the less alone I feel, the easier it is to do my work. Because I get it. Because I get that it's not, you know, it's not like you emerge one day out of your cocoon and you're a superwoman. It just never happens.
Right.
What you just learn to walk with the fear and almost befriend it. Which is not to say it becomes easy. It never becomes easy, but it does become. It does become manageable. And for the women I know who are just like warriors out there battling, that's the key they've learned. It's not that they become fearless, it's that they befriend the fear and manage it.
Damn, that's good. Thank you.
Bang! I should write a book.
Boom, yeah. Baby. Boom!
I'm on a roll. I haven't even had my coffee yet and I spit that out.
Yo! All right, well, we got it here, and I'm so happy to have connected with you, and more to come. Thank you so much, Amanda.
Thank you. This was great.
Take care.